What was that? How much time did you have to get those pictures of Earth? How quickly did that have to happen? That turned into the stamp. Yeah, go ahead, Jim. Yeah.
The sequence of actually taking that photograph was something like this. I think it was taken on the third revolution, because the first two we were concentrated on what we're doing, looking at the moon, checking out the craters, making sure the orbit that we had was consistent with what was going to happen in the future. And then on the third orbit, we suddenly saw on the right window, I think. In fact, I think it was me. The funny thing, the Earth came up, and I said, "Look at that!" And then either Bill or Frank said, "Oh gosh, look at that!" And then I said, "We ought to take a photograph of that." And but that time, the spacecraft started to move. It was moving around, and we lost sight of it until it came around to the left window. And I saw it up again, and I said, "You've got to take a photograph of this." And so Bill got the camera, but it had black and white film in it, and I got the color film after he yelled at me once or twice. And he put the color film in, and then, of course, he took the picture. But I'll let you know a little secret. I said, "Bill, this is the way it goes. You compose it in this manner. You see how the lunar surface goes down this way and the Earth comes up that way. Now, just now, okay, take it." And I showed him where the button was.
I'm going to tell Bill what he just said.
You know, you could do that right now, Walt. You know, you got one of these if you want.
Jim, I remember there was a time when Neil was a backup on Gemini 8, and you and I were on the crew because Mike Collins was on Gemini, or the E mission to begin with.
Yeah, Neil flew Jim. Was Gemini 8.
Let's go back to the Bible. whose idea, where did that come from for you and Bill?
It's a good thing. I think Frank could probably really tell more about exactly how we read the first 10 verses.
As one of the geniuses of NASA, and one of the things that I thought was unusual again about this organization, we were told about 6 weeks before the flight that we were going to have a television program around while we're going around the moon that would probably have the largest audience that had ever listened to a human voice. And you know, we were all up to our ears and trying to figure out how to what we're going to do. And so I asked Julian Shear, who was head of PR, I said, "What do you want us to do?" And the only answer we got was something appropriate. He said, "Do something appropriate." Uh-huh. Can you imagine that happening today? Huh? And so we were busy, and we all tried to come up with something, and that it all ended up seeming trite to it. So I had a good friend in Washington, Cy Borg, and I called him up and I said, "Cy, you got to help us." He had worked for Newsweek, and he was a wonderful man, and he tried to come up with it, and he couldn't. So he finally passed it off to a friend, Joe Leighton, I believe it was, and he was a long-time writer. He couldn't come up with it either, but finally his wife, who had been raised in a convent in France and was a French resistance writer, came down after he'd been making attempts all night, and she said, "Well, why don't you start at the beginning?" And he said, "Where?" And she said, "Genesis in the Bible," and that's how it happened.
Wow.
So, incidentally, we never got that. We didn't clear it. We didn't do it. I don't think you guys even knew what we were going to say. That was a genius of this country. It was wonderful.
Wow.
One more little tidbit on this. After we did that, we got back, we were sued for combining government and we had a talk at Congress with a joint venture, and we mentioned that, and the Supreme Court justices were down there, and they said, "Don't worry about it, we'll take care of it."
got Madeline Murray O'Hara that sued, right? Was that Frank? Madeline Murray O'Hara, right?
Madeline Murray O'Hara, yeah.
Jim Lovell was going to fly with Neil and I, and it wasn't because Jim Lovell talked so much that he moved to Frank's flight on Apollo 8, but it was because Mike Collins needed a back operation for a pinched nerve. So that's why Fred ended up on the backup crew for Apollo 8. And now Neil felt that Mike, having not been involved in Apollo 8, should be involved in Apollo 11. And I guess they finally felt that I was up to that kind of a mission. So when the announcement did come up, I remember going back and saying to Joan, you know, we're going to land a mission, we're going to make a try, and I would almost prefer to be on a later flight that does more interesting things. But rather than being at the peak of all the public attention, which I did not look forward to at all, but I realized that the crewmates I had, there was no way that I could even come close. And so that person at that time, my wife, was the only one that knew I said anything about that at the time.
So how surprised were you when Neil got out, said what he said, walked around, and then took that picture of you? That's you in that photograph from Apollo 11.
But in the training, the three of us felt that maybe there was a 60% chance that we would be able to land successfully. But of course, there were many things that could happen. Right, Frank? Or Jim? Yeah, there were many things that could happen that would cause things to be aborted. So we felt there was a 95% chance of coming home safely, but a 60% chance of being able to successfully land.
What do the numbers...
Six out of seven flights landed on the moon, and we were not using a Ouija board or anything. We just guessed that was about our odds.
What do the numbers 1201 and 1202 mean to you?
Well, before the mission, not a whole lot. We knew that there was a book about this thick with all the procedures and all the program alarms that could come up. And we had started the descent, and as we were starting the maneuver, going face down, Neil looked down and he said, I think we're going to be a little bit long. And I said, how in the world can he possibly, at the beginning of powered descent, come up and say, I think we're going to be a little long? Well, a little further along, we had to yaw around and pitch forward so the landing radar could pick up the surface. And so now we're facing forward, but still the engine is pointing. And a while after that, a program alarm comes on. And what it does is it wipes out the displays of what you're looking at, and the alarm goes, and so you shut off the alarm, and it restores it to what it is, but we don't know what the program alarm is, but there's this dictionary bound between us, and we were just not going to pull out the dictionary to look and see what it was. But there happened to be an engineer who had been very well schooled And I think you ought to take over from here, Jim.
Yeah, I think that's a real interesting point there, because the go back into, you mentioned training when we started. And by this time in the space program, the training was truly exceptional. And we had a team of controllers whose principal job was to test the team from a standpoint of knowledge, the integration with the crew right on down the line. We got a CAPCOM, I had Charlie Duke in this. And generally the final training run was always looked at by the team as sort of graduation exercise. Why the simulation supervisor that decided this team isn't ready to graduate yet? So he threw us a decent series of problems in there, one of which we started exercising or experiencing various program alarms. And we aborted, we saw the program alarms, we aborted the training run. And then Sim Soup comes in and says, Flight, why did you abort that training run? Your mission rule says you need two cues. What was your second cue? There was none. So we got together with the Draper Labs, and overnight we learned an awful lot about the program alarms. And it's interesting, the actual descent, Buzz mentioned that we were going to be downrange. What happened? The crew had not fully depressurized the tunnel. We have a dumb computer on board the spacecraft, so over the period of time at two orbits, basically we're now further downrange than we should have been. And immediately, as soon as we acquire, my trajectory guy says we're halfway to our abort limit on radio component of velocity, and abort is not a word that you use casually in mission control. But basically, we worked that problem. We were starting monitoring that. But as we were waiting for the landing radar to come in to update the true altitude that the spacecraft was above the surface, we experienced that same set of program alarms that we had in our final training run.